the army wanted to supply these fruits and vegetables to the soldiers, but it's also a result of the fact that after 1967, it just became much, much easier to actually do it. And there were times, there's no doubt, when in the army or big organizations, there are times when, whether you, without knowing about it, you're eating Arab fruits and vegetables exclusively, right? And that's something that exists in the state of Israel since 1967. So that's the history. So what I think is important to know, to learn from the historical or the history that that I try to present, is that first, that the door was never closed on kiyum of the mitzvahs of Shemitah. No one, of Yisrael Chanan and not Rav Kook, wanted people to abandon the obligation of Shemitah in favor of the Heter Mechira. The Heter Mechira was always seen as a solution for a particular problem. And every time the Heter Mechira was imposed, was employed, it was employed with reservation. And the Rabbonim always said, next time, 7 years from now, we'll look at the matter again, we'll investigate it, we'll see how much, we'll see what it is that we should do in 7 years, but there's no automatic continuance of the Heter Mechira from one Shemitah to the next. Now, I don't want to get involved, I don't want to get involved with the details of the problems of the Heter Mechira. What I think is important for you to know is that the Chazon Ish, who came to Eretz Yisrael, the first book that the Chazon Ish published in Eretz Yisrael was the book that he wrote on Zeroy in 1938. He published the book in 1938. In that book he comes out, he makes very, very strongly against the Heter Mechira. He says that the Heter Mechira, it's also to do it, and it doesn't help. I mean, that was his position. That's pretty definitive, right? On the other hand, of course, you have the position of Rav Kook, which was, we don't want to do it, and we would rather not do it, and if it's possible to avoid it, we should avoid it, but if you do the Heter Mechira, it'll work. Today, there are Rabbanim that assume both sides of this barrier. Shlomo Zalman in Yerushalayim, the great poskim of our generation, feels that the Heter Mechira, the Chatchila, should not be done, that there is a problem, as in Israel Lo Sechonem, you're not allowed to sell Eretz Yisrael to a Goy, right? Same thing, the same kind of problem that we have when we talk about peace, right? That it's a painful thing to think of Jews giving Eretz Yisrael to Goyim, but it's not simply painful in a psychological or an emotional way, but it's halakhically forbidden. It's forbidden for Jews to sell parts of Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews. And he says that the kind of sale that you want to make, where you sell but you don't really sell, and you know that you're getting it back at the time that you sell it, is that kind of sale has no effect in any event. That's what the Chazon Ish says. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, even though it's also to sell the land of Israel, if you do sell it in this way, the sale is, even though you've done something that you shouldn't do, the sale is effective. And so Rav Shlomo Zalman holds that b'di'evid, if you find yourself in a difficult situation, you can use the Heter Mechira, or you can rely on the Heter Mechira. Generally speaking, to the best of my knowledge, the poskim, all of the poskim, have reservations about the Heter Mechira, and some of them feel that it's a worthless gambit. Certainly, everybody would agree that if the Heter Mechira would help Jews, part of Klal Yisrael, achieve their place in Olam Haba a little bit better, then certainly it's worth doing the Heter Mechira. However, I don't think that for Bnei Terah, there's a feeling today that using the Heter Mechira is a reasonable a priori halachic position today for people who want to keep the Torah mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael. Now, if you don't use the Heter Mechira, what do you do? What do you do if you don't keep the Heter Mechira? So there are basically two positions. One of them is very simple, and one of them is more complicated, and then there's a third option which I will discuss. The simplest option, as I've told you, is the solution accepted by the Rabbonim of Yerushalayim Midurei Deros, and that is that fruit and vegetables grown by Arabs on land owned by Arabs and non-Jews on land owned by non-Jews, in several versions of the Hetzer Mechira, the emphasis is that it's better to sell, of course, to a Yishmaeli, to a Muslim, than to sell to anybody else. The Israel is to sell, because some Christians may be still in the category of idolaters, and you don't want to sell Eretz Yisrael to idolaters, but Yishmaelim are, you know, the Muslims are not considered to be idolaters. I mean, they haven't got it quite right, but they're not, you know, they're not the idolaters. So this heter, the Rabbanim Yerushalayim, as I explain, is a heter that makes life in Yerushalayim very easy. If you accept the heter, I mean, the heter of the Rabbanim Yerushalayim is also a heter. It's not like the heter Mechira is a heter, and this is not a heter. This is also a heter that the Chazon Ish, as I'll get to that in a moment, Chazon Ish disagrees with the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim and feels that even the land that's owned nominally by Arabs in Eretz Yisrael for the purpose of Shemitah is not owned by the Arabs. But the heter of the Rabbanim, I mean, we're not going to determine this issue. The issue between the Chazon Ish and the Rosh Hashanah, we're not going to determine. And the tradition of long-standing in Yerushalayim is that you can eat fruits and vegetables if they were grown by Arabs. Now that means, practically, if you go to a restaurant, any restaurant or any hotel that has a hashgacha of any badatz, or has a hashgacha of the Rabbanut Yerushalayim Mahadrin, that means that the fruits and vegetables that you'll eat will probably be fruits and vegetables that came from some Arab source, right? Now that doesn't mean that the other 6 years I explained anything different happens. It may be that all the 6 years you've also been eating fruits and vegetables that come from an Arab source. But if the hashgacha is a badatz hashgacha or the Rabbanut Mehadrin of Yerushalayim, you know the Rabbanut of Yerushalayim has two standards of hashgacha, then that's what you're going to get in fruits and vegetables, and I think that's the preferred option. There are so many places in Yerushalayim to eat that make this hashgacha available that I think that this is the thing that you should do. I mean, no one should adopt a standard that's lower than the standard of the badatzim in Yerushalayim. Now, in other cities, this also exists. I mean, exists in Haifa, exists in Netanya, in Tel Aviv, in Chedera. But in the other cities, the availability and the clientele is much smaller. So that if you find yourself in, you know, some city in Israel, find yourself in Nes Ziona or Petach Tikva or Gedera or, you know, any of those moshavot that started this whole business off, and your makbid not to eat peirot that are heter mechirat peirot. So you have to be careful and look around until you find what it is that you are looking for. Within this system, I don't think that you should bechlau. I mean, this is a more general topic. But I think I should mention it here now. Sometimes people come from Chutz La'aretz. I mean, I hope that the people sitting here are not in that category, but I know I've often met tourists, you know, who tell me that, well, of course you can eat any place because it's Israel. You know, they have this idea that there's a sanctity in Israel which turns, I don't know, pig fat into a keteris. I don't know exactly what they think is going on. But in fact, I have the sad, I'm sad to report, but it is in fact true that there are a lot of people who don't eat kosher food in Israel, and that eating tray food in Israel is pretty much exactly the same as eating tray food anyplace else. I mean, it's just as treif. It's not any less treif. I want to tell you something else. I say it's not true that if you have a relative that you haven't seen since you were born, but has some claim on you through some exotic relationship, through your aunt or your second cousin who came in Aliyah 47 years ago, that does not mean that they serve kosher food. I mean, there is no relationship, you understand? I mean, people can serve tray food even if they're related to you. Not only that, there are people who think they're kosher, but have very weird ideas about what that means. And generally, if you find a person, you're looking at a relative of yours, who embodies the following two qualities. One, they're obviously not shomer any mitzvahs. And two, they don't seem to know anything about Torah. Then the chances that when they tell you that they have a kosher kitchen, that it's kosher, well, the chances are not that good. And if you come back and say to me, well, I went away for Shabbos and they told me that it was all right. What about this? And you ask me this like question. Well, I mean, I don't consider that to be a responsible act. You know, we are to some extent responsible for ourselves. And we have an obligation to do mitzvot. And that obligation does not come into conflict. It's not like an existential question. Should I keep the mitzvah or be a nice guy? There is no such question in halakha. There isn't. You have to keep the mitzvot, period. You want to be a nice guy, be a nice guy. But you can't eat tray food and be a nice guy. That's not the way it works. So, people who don't know anything about Torah and who don't keep mitzvot, any ostensible mitzvot, despite their protestations that they have a warm Jewish heart and may be great contributors to the UJA, should not be hired as chefs. So what you do is you go out to eat in a kosher restaurant, but you don't go to their house to eat. So, as far as Shemitah is concerned, if you have a relative who serves kosher food, not imaginary kosher food, right? The American used to call, when I was a kid, used to be kosher style food. Because you used to take tray food and put a Jewish name on it. And that was called kosher style, and certain people felt good about that. This may be psychologically wonderful, but is halachically limited. So, if you go to visit a relative, and the relative is taka kosher, you know, 100% in the Shomer Shabbos, and they're frum, and they send their kids to frum schools, because that's where it counts, that's how you know, they send their kids to frum schools, so they're frum, mistomer. And they rely on the hetter mechira, and it's important for you to eat there. So you have to ask a shayla. I mean, if your minhag is not to eat, then your shayla could be that somebody will tell you it's mutter to eat under those circumstances. But first, the food has to be kosher, right? And the further away you get from people who are careful about these things, the less likely that the food is going to be kosher. It's not that hard to make kosher food treif, right? It's not good enough to go to the supermarket to the kosher section. You know, in Israel, there's no kosher section. Everything in Israel is kosher. But everything in Israel is not kosher. And not everything in Israel is prepared in a kosher way. And not everybody in Israel knows that milchiks and fleishiks could be cooked together in the oddest ways to produce bona fide Isurim Doraisa, like, you know, really good ones. They don't know that. They don't know that, and you do know that. So that's what you have to do. It's not like, you know, well, you know, it's my relative. What will my mother say? Your mother will be very proud that you know what's going on. And there are other ways to solve the familial relationship question. You can deal with that, but you have to know what you're doing. So if there's a kosher home, and if they rely on the Hatam Mechira, and if it's important for you to accept their hospitality, then you have to, then I think, what I would do, since I don't rely on the Hatam Mechira, is I would ask a Shaila. But I can tell you, it is likely that at certain times you would be given the opportunity to actually rely on the Hatam Mechira in a particular case, right? Not unilaterally, if you've accepted the limitation that I set forth, but in a general case. Now, there's another more complicated way of keeping Shemitah, which of course is based on the fact that, as the Chazon Ish said, there's no way to usurp the Shemitah from Eretz Yisrael. You can neither usurp it by claiming that these Arabs have owned the land for 800 years, nor can you usurp it by selling it to the land to them in any way, manner, or form. Therefore, as a result, according to the Chazon Ish, all the fruits and vegetables that are grown in Eretz Yisrael, in the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, which itself is a matter of halachic discussion, but if it's truly within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael that you grow these fruits and vegetables, then the fruits and vegetables have kedusha shvius. Now, this has wide-ranging implications on all kinds of levels, but what that means is you can't buy them or sell them. You can't buy them or sell them, and you can't treat them improperly. You can't throw them away. You can't do to them what you do with other fruits and vegetables. Therefore, if you go to Bnei Brak, where many people follow the position of the Chazon Ish in this matter, you'll see that there are all sorts of odd arrangements made for buying and selling from stores, where you kind of buy something with something else, or you pay for the work that the seller put into actually getting the fruit, but you don't pay for the fruit itself. Then when you eat the fruits of the vegetables, you have to be careful to eat them in the way they are usually eaten, not to process them in an odd way. And then when you eat them, you have to make sure that the rinds or the peels or whatever is left over, which is also part of the fruit, are put away in a place where they could be allowed to rot naturally before you throw them away. In other words, the solution, based on the position of the Chazon Ish, is somewhat more complicated. But today it happens, just I'm telling you as a statistical reality or as a statistical fact, many people, more and more people each year, are accepting the strictures of as laid down by the Chazon Ish as binding. Another possibility which was tried last Shemitah and will be tried again this Shemitah is the possibility of an Otzer Bezdin. In other words, it's possible for the Bezdin to set up a bank, a fruit bank, where the Bezdin buys fruit from farmers and we buy the fruit from the Bezdin at a set price. It was somehow avoiding the problem of doing business with the payros of Shvius. The Otzer Bezdin solution is really a very machmir solution. It's much more machmir than the solution of the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim. It enables people to deal with fruit that has kedusha shvius. So you have the feeling that you're a little bit more involved with doing the mitzvah than just eating the fruit and ignoring the implications of what you're doing. Last Shemitah there was an Otzer Bezdin here of the Yishuvim of Gush Etzion. There was an Otzer Bezdin that was established in Tanuva. Generally, it's difficult. The Otzer Bezdin has had in the past difficulty in disseminating the produce in a way that would make it easy for the consumer to get at it. In other words, you can't just take it and put it in a supermarket. It's got to be kept separate. You've got to know that this is the Otsa Bezdin's property. It creates objective difficulties. What we're going to do in the yeshiva, is rely generally on the heter of the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim. There was used produce from Tnuva that was grown by the Arabs. However, when we're able to get fruits from the Otsa Bezdin, there'll be a sign that's put up that the fruit that you're getting, the apples, the pears, whatever, are from the Otsa Bezdin. You should treat the fruits with Kedusha Shvias, which means that you should eat them, but not throw away whatever's left over. There'll be some place to put whatever's left over until it rots, and then it'll be thrown away. That's the solution that is going to be adopted in the yeshiva. I think that's a good solution for people to adopt if they have a home. If they live in a home, and to have fruits and vegetables, fruits that come from the Otsa Bezdin, is certainly makes you feel more involved with the mitzvah of Shemitah. I would summarize everything I said as follows. It seems to me that the heter, mechira, was never imagined to be a heter in the manner of other heters, heterim, where the heterim are universal, unilateral, fixed, and eventually become accepted by Klal Yisrael. The nature of the heter was that it has to be reinvestigated every Shemitah. Since the establishment of the State of Israel, the reinvestigation has led more and more Rabbonim, more and more Bnei Terah, in the direction of not relying on the heter mechira, if possible, and relegating the heter mechira to a kind of a measure which is aimed at helping Klal Yisrael reduce the nature of their disengagement from Torah. On the other hand, I did point out to Rav Shlomo Zalman, one of the great poskim, holds that b'dieved, if somebody, even though you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't sell the land of Eretz Yisrael, but b'dieved, if you've sold the land of Eretz Yisrael, the heter mechira works, and you can in fact use the payers of Shvia. So I'm not saying that anybody who uses the heter mechira, chas v'shalom, is not doing something that is legitimate in halacha. It just seems to me that the mainstream halachic position seems to be more in the direction of avoiding the heter mechira. The methods of avoidance are the regulations of the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim, where you use Arab produce, or the position of the Chazon Ish, where everything grown in Eretz Yisrael has Kedusha Shvias, and we have to act accordingly. A third possibility for some of the fruits that may be available to us is the Otsa Bezdin. And therefore, practically, I point out to you that badatzin, every badatz, it doesn't matter. I saw in the very silly article in the Jerusalem Post, which is not, usually does not disappoint in having some silly articles. This was a particularly silly article about Shemitah, where the implication was that if there are a lot of badatzim, they must have a lot of different positions on Shemitah, whereas that is not the case. There's a lot of badatzim, and they all have the exact same position on Shemitah and do exactly the same thing. And all the badatzim are careful that the produce that they serve, or that they put the badatz hechsher on, comes from either produce from before the Shemitah year, in the case of Sunfrost, that's what they did, or produce that comes from Arabs during the Shemitah year. As a curiosity, I would like to tell you that in Gush Katif there was a little bit of a problem, but now it's been straightened out. Gush Katif has a different way of solving the problem. It has nothing to do with Shemitah. It has to do with the fact that in Gush Katif they wanted to grow bugless lettuce, right? And bugless cauliflower, right? Cabbage, bugless cabbage. That's what they wanted to do, right? They wanted a Shemitah factory. They were a bugless factory. So the way they did it was they grow the lettuce in bags. It's not on the ground. It is on the ground. You put on the ground. They put these corrugated sheets. Now they cover the earth with these corrugated sheets. I don't know if they're made out of tin or if they're made out of cement or some kind of, but they cover them with corrugated sheets. They take these large bags, they're like garbage bags, you know, and they fill the bag with earth. And then in that they plant cabbage. They plant the cabbage and they put it in a hothouse. Right? Then they come in and they spray DDT, enough DDT to kill anything, but they don't spray it on the cabbage. You know, they spray it on the ground, which is not where the cabbage. You actually get sprayless lettuce and sprayless and bugless because the bugs that are left can't get up. They can't climb up on the bag or something. I don't know. But that's what they do. But it turns out that this is also a reasonable solution to Shemitah. Because, and this Rabbi Schrader may have mentioned to you, that, you know, of course, the Shemitah vegetables, that, you know, Shemitah applies to things that were grown in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Eretz Yisrael. So if I grow a tomato in a pot, right, that's not in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, the Gemara says that you have to be careful, because sometimes pots get their sustenance from Eretz Yisrael, even though it's a pot. So like if I took a pot, and there's a hole in the bottom of the pot, right, which is what the Gemara calls an atzitz nakuv, and you put the pot down on the earth, but you didn't dig a hole and put it deep into the earth, and there was a tomato in the pot. So the Gemara asked the question, where is that tomato growing? Is it growing in Eretz Yisrael, or is it growing in space someplace, right? So the Gemara says, if you have an atzitz nakuv, you put on the ground, so it's certainly growing in Eretz Yisrael, because the sustenance comes from Eretz Yisrael. Everybody knows that if you leave it there for a long time, the roots are going to crawl out of that hole and go down into the ground. What happens if you take the atzitz and hang it over the ground of Eretz Yisrael? You know, like the tomato still wants to get sustenance from the ground of Eretz Yisrael, but can it or can't it? That's also a question in the Gemara, right? Question. There are many poskim who say that that is also growing in Eretz Yisrael. What if I take my pot and I put it over a slab of cement, like in my house, right? I have a floor of cement. Maybe then it's not in Eretz Yisrael anymore. So that in Gush Katif, what they actually managed to produce by trying to avoid making bugged lettuce, they produced an option for growing things that are acceptable on the Shemitah year. And therefore, they will also, even though they're Jews, farming, maybe in Eretz Yisrael, I mean, not in Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yoshev is machmir that it is in Eretz Yisrael, even though it's not clear that Gush Katif is in Eretz Yisrael, according to these, to the issue of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael from the time of Ezra. Rabbi Yoshev is machmir, so if you say, even if you say that Gush Katif is in Eretz Yisrael, which is, halachically dubious. This is a non-political statement. You still can eat the stuff from Gush Katif because it's not grown in the land, right? It's not grown in the land. It's grown somehow above the land, and that also doesn't apply to the Shemitah. Doesn't apply to that. Yeah.
And one was from the Chabadish, and the other one was the Ephraim. And they sound very similar.
Well, they are. The point that I'm saying is that even people who accept the heter of the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim and use fruits and vegetables grown by non-Jews, they may also have available to them fruits from the Otz HaBezdin, which they may opt to use. Because generally in Yerushalayim, you don't have Shemitah stores of the Chazon Ish variety. But you might have fruits from the Otz HaBezdin from this area. The Yishuvim of Gush Etzion. Because the Yishuvim of Gush Etzion make an Otz HaBezdin. The fruit from that Otz HaBezdin may find its way to the stores in Yerushalayim. All the other fruit in the stores in Yerushalayim is generally Arab fruit and vegetables. So in Yerushalayim you have these two options. The main option that you have is to buy the fruit with the hefsher, the badatz, or mahadri Yerushalayim, which is Arab fruit. Sometime during the year, you may find in your supermarket or in some store fruit from the Otzer Bezdin of the Yishuvim of Gush Etzion. So you have the option. At that time, you could say to yourself, I'll buy these apples, or I'll buy these apples. The difference being that if you buy the apples from the Otzer Bezdin, you could have a higher level of involvement in doing the mitzvah Shemitah. Keeping the mitzvahs associated with Shemitah, that's what I mean. There's no mitzvah to eat an apple. Right? You can also opt not to eat apples. They operate a combination of, they have their Otzer Bezdin and have a special way of selling things. They don't sell, they don't weigh the fruit in the regular way. They have some kind of set rate for the expenses of the storekeepers per kilo. They have a more complicated way of doing it. But in Yerushalayim, the stores generally don't operate that way. So I didn't go into that. That's how it usually is. It's generally true in Bnei Brak. Yeah. What?
How does the Kabbalist store sort out vegetables
with the source of vegetables? There's a problem. I didn't go into it. There are dates. In other words, you have to know when it is no longer possible to eat. In other words, the only thing to do is to store up things, sell them, buy them, bring them from Chutz La'aretz, and all kinds of possibilities, but it's a svichit, it's a big problem. Yeah?
Okay, but if the svichit starts, around December for vegetables.
Yeah.
So does that mean practically that you can't buy, ignoring the Arabs, that's not a problem.
Right.
Okay, but you cannot otherwise buy or eat vegetables or
well, you could import them, for example. And the State of Israel imports things every year, all the time, and distributes them equitably. If they would decide on the Shemitah year to import things and distribute them inequitably, in other words, have all the imported stuff go to one place in Israel, leaving more of the regular produce every place else in Israel, then that would be another way of solving the problem. Not December, but there are dates. There's a chart.
Once we know what the date is, that after that date, you cannot buy and use any fruit or vegetables.
That's smichin. And it's smichin. You can buy sun frost, you know, frozen vegetables and fruits,
mm-hmm.
because that's from last year. Anything from last year, you can buy. There are the cans of produce that you get are all dated. Right? What?
Arab produce.
Yeah, we said, if you're not buying Arab produce, if you're buying Arab produce, so then the problem is solved. Right? These are svichins that this has to do with Jews, or with fruit that has Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, that might have Kedushas Shvias.
Right.
So
you cannot buy, you can't buy that.
What do you mean you? In Yerushalayim, we use stuff that comes from Arabs.
I understand.
So that problem is yes. How do they solve this problem in Bnei Brak?
Why?
Is that your question?
Okay.
They either stockpile it, they stockpile cans, they stockpile vegetables, or they bring it from Chutz La'aretz.
Okay.
That's how they do it. Okay.
והכולה בשביל
אתה מבין אנגלית? טוב. The question is, he asked just in theory, why isn't it better to support Jewish enterprise in Eretz Israel rather than supporting non-Jewish enterprise in Eretz Israel? And he added also the caveat that he said, "Matzav kashe," that the situation for agriculture in Eretz Israel is difficult. Is difficult. That was the question. I tried I made a point which I hoped would help to avoid dealing with this question. It's a question that I don't want to deal with. The reason that I don't want to deal with it is that in order to deal with it, we have to know what the facts are. This is often very painful, a very painful process to find out what the facts really are. But if we don't know what the facts are, I told you that that there is no change on the Shemitah year. That the Arabs do not sell fruit and vegetable to the Jews. Rabbi David Marshall. I know who he is. I don't know who he is, but I looked at it yesterday, and it's done in an interesting manner. It sort of like answers questions. It's like you ask, like, what do you do if, all the kind of questions that you're asking, and the answers, an answer to the question appears in the book. I don't know any more about it. There are two other books that I'd like you to know about. One is this book called Mitzvot Ha'aretz Kehilchatan, which is also from our library, written by Avram Goldberg. This is actually the second book that he wrote on the topic. He wrote another book earlier about the mitzvot that flowed by Eretz, and this is a good book. It contains a lot of information, and I'm going to use it for part of the discussion that we have. Another book is this book called Sefer HaShvi'it V'Hilchoteha, which is based on the Pesachim of Rav Avadi Yosef. The reason that I point to these two books in particular is, even though there are several other really excellent books that have come out on the market, a book that was written by Rav Reichenberg, which I brought to the yeshiva yesterday someplace. What's it called? Just tell me what it's called. Mishpatei Aretz. So that's a very good book about, deals also with practical problems, with problems of a garden and flowers and atzitzim and all the kinds of things that are practical. Now, in this book, the reason that I quote these two books, the book by, the summary by Goldberg and the summary of the halachot of Rav Yosef, is because this book, the book by Goldberg, leans in the direction very strongly of not accepting the Heter Mechira, of course, unless it's under very special kinds of situations, whereas, as you know, that Rav Avadi Yosef is a proponent of the Heter Mechira. At least he always argues that against the Chazon Ish, that the Heter Mechira has validity, and that if you use it, you're certainly within the strictures of the law. However, as we will see, the actual position, halakha l'maaseh, of these two books is not really so far apart. Even though he leans towards the Chazon Ish and this book is Rav Avadi Yosef, l'maaseh, they are not far away at all. This book of Rav Goldberg's book, includes a historical overview of the problem of Shemitah in Eretz Yisrael in modern times. Now, this historical overview is copied from another book, an earlier book, that was written called Sefer Shemitah by Rav Tkachinsky. Rav Tkachinsky is the same Rav Tkachinsky who wrote the famous Luach. You know, the Luach Yerushalayim, I mean, that's the Luach that is used in many, many shuls. That Rav Tkachinsky, his son is still a Rav in the same place that his father was a Rav, opposite the central bus station in Yerushalayim. So Rav Tkachinsky, in his book, wrote a historical overview of the Heter Mechira in modern times. Now, the question is, why did he do this? Why did he write this historical overview? I mean, generally, those of you who are at all involved with halakha or know anything about halakha know that halachists are not generally concerned about historical development. They're only interested in the conceptual development of the halachic issues. And yet in this case, after Rav Tkachinsky wrote a book about the Shemitah in which he adopts his position, which was the position of most of the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim against using the Heter Mechira, but of course in Yerushalayim they use another Heter, which is also formidable and which makes life fairly reasonable, at least in Yerushalayim. When he finished that, he wrote this historical overview. Now, what the historical overview says is as follows. First, it points out that the modern history of agriculture starts around 1860, when the when Jews moved from Yerushalayim to Motza. You know, Motza is a little bit outside of Yerushalayim. There's a big an industrial winery in Motza, Yenot, something or other, and Motza probably, and oh, Efrat. Oh, you see that? I knew somebody would, you know, clue in. So, yes, that's what it's called. Apparently, due to an earlier geographic confusion about, you know, where anything was. Maybe we're really in Motza. I don't know. So farmers moved out to Motza, and it was such a small affair that they were able to keep the Shemitah, and on the years, I mean, as it says in the Torah, I mean, no one thought, even though I assume that Rabbi Schrader told you that it's not perfectly clear what our obligation today is to the Shemitah, but most halachists assume that there is an obligation to Rabbanan to keep Shemitah on the particular year that was designated, even though that also is problematic, but it's a little too esoteric and it'll take us too far away from the practicality of things. So I said, we all know that there is an issue about the nature of the obligation of Shemitah, and we all know that there is an issue about the years, counting the years or designating the years of Shemitah. But assuming that we have accepted the fact that there is a designated Shemitah year, which is accepted by Klal Yisrael, and assuming that we've accepted the fact that most of the poskim agree that there is a drabanan obligation, at least, for keeping the Shemitah. And we know that keeping the Shemitah means not being involved in agricultural activity. I mean, lechatchila, right before you get involved with tricks, lechatchila. But at that time, in 1860, it was actually possible for people not to work the land for a year, to look for alternate work. I mean, everybody was very poor, and it didn't really it didn't affect the flow of life. In 1878, Petach Tikva was established, and this was a more serious enterprise. Also, Petach Tikva was established by people who left Yerushalayim to go and become farmers. I mean, you know, the Zionism of the diaspora, I mean, I'm not sure that this is true, but it seems to me that the Zionism which originated in the diaspora, which also included this will to be independent, self-reliant, what was called by some people at that time normal, as opposed to being living in countries by royal fiat or by the agreement of the king or the duke or whoever happened to be at that time. That feeling that there had to be in Eretz Yisrael established an independent community also had an effect on the Haredi community that existed in Yerushalayim, in Tveria, in Tzfat, before the Zionist movement made its impact. And as a result, religious people went and established yeshuvim. They established places where they lived and worked, like Petach Tikva, Rishon LeZion, Ekron, Nes Ziona, Rosh Pina, Gedera, Yisora, Mala. These are names of places in Israel, all of which are towns or cities today, but in those days did not exist and were established by small groups of people who went, and their intention was to farm the land and to earn a living in that way. They tried, these people, the religious people, of course, they were not interested in tricks, and they kept Shemitah, and they avoided eating svichin, and they accepted the hora'ot of the Beit Din of Yerushalayim. They basically accepted the regulations of the Beit Din of Yerushalayim. In Yerushalayim, right before this time, of course, there was Shemitah years. But in Yerushalayim, the problem was minimized because for a very, very long time in Yerushalayim, they had accepted the fact that if land was owned by and farmed by non-Jews, then the produce produced on that land and by those non-Jews was not within the boundaries of the Isser that applies to Kedush, that creates the problems of Kedushas Shvius. In other words, the fruit and the vegetables that were produced around Yerushalayim by the Arabs were not problematic for the Jews who lived in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim. And so for years, Shemitah had always been kept in Yerushalayim. Shemitah had always been kept in Yerushalayim, and it was kept in that way by eating Arab produce. In fact, they ate Arab produce all the time, not only during the Shemitah year. They ate the Arab produce during all the years, in the Shuk, in Me'e Sharim, if you ask old people, you know, people who look like they're old, people who are around before 1948 in Yerushalayim. So you know that in Me'e Sharim, there's a Shuk, right? If you go walk down Me'e Sharim before you get to Bratslev, and you make a right turn, and then you make another right turn. So now it's already a little bit modern, but there's a Shuk there. Like, not as big as the Shuk of Machon Yehuda, but there's a Shuk. Now, before 1948, everybody in the Shuk who worked in the Shuk was an Arab, right? It was a Shuk of Arabs. They brought Arab produce into the Shuk. I mean, there was no tzeduva. Maybe it was a little before 1948, you know, then already Jewish produce was making inroads. But for many years, because of that, because of the psak of the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim, Shemitah was not a problem. There was no issue. I assume that they probably in their homes didn't have many potted plants, or, you know, this minhag of bringing colored flowers on for every Shabbos probably was not also so common in those days. I mean, people were very poor, and flowers are not something that very poor people who live in stone houses with whose front porch is also made out of stone and their backyard is also made out of stone. I mean, it's not so easy to imagine, you know, that the flower business was such a big business in those days. So flowers are not a problem, and atzitzim were probably also not such a problem. And the main thing was getting fruits and vegetables to eat, and that was easily done because people used to eat fruits and vegetables that came from Arabs. So that when we say that the people in Petach Tikva and Nes Ziona, the people who went west, right, in the direction of Tel Aviv, they followed the dictates or the regulations of the Rabbanut in Yerushalayim. I mean, that's what we mean. The Rabbanut in Yerushalayim said, look, we always keep Shemitah. We don't have any problem with keeping Shemitah. And what we do is we buy Arab produce. There are plenty of Arabs all over Israel in those days, apparently. You know, if you've read some Leon Uris novel, you know that's true. And it's true, there were Arabs all over, so you could always go to an Arab and get tomatoes. And if you didn't work for a year, it wasn't such a big problem. But then, with the development of the Yishuv, there were a lot of people suddenly trying to support themselves agriculturally. And these people needed some sort of way of dealing with the economic problem that they created for themselves. Since they were supporting themselves by chaklaut, by farming, they suddenly discovered that on the seventh year, they either wouldn't be able to support themselves as well, or they wouldn't be able to maintain what they had built up. They were worried for a variety of reasons. This led to the first heter. And the first heter was, interestingly enough, was not, of course, they turned to Rabbanim, there was also an involvement. In those days, if you went from Yerushalayim to be a farmer in Nes Ziona, right? You didn't just go. You didn't like come home and tell your wife that you're going to be a farmer in Nes Ziona, which didn't exist. There was an organization that promoted farming in Nes Ziona. Now that organization was called Chovevei Tzion. Now Chovevei Tzion also existed in the diaspora, and they used to organize people to come to Eretz Yisrael. But in Eretz Yisrael, there was also Chol Beit Zion. Now, Chol Beit Zion was in turn backed up financially by the Baron Rothschild. Baron Rothschild was not a religious person, but he understood and he knew that you had to, that religious people were part of Klal Yisrael, and that you had to also accommodate religious people, especially if they were willing to go and be farmers in Eretz Yisrael. So, because Chol Beit Zion was a diaspora organization, it turned out that they turned to the Gdolei HaRabbanim in the diaspora and asked them what to do. And there was a meeting. There was a meeting in Warsaw that took place, and three Rabbanim, three great Rabbanim, Rav Shmuel Molover was sort of the Rav of Chol Beit Zion. Because even though Chol Beit Zion was not a religious movement, there were religious people in the movement, and Rav Shmuel Molover was considered to be, he was a great Rav, a great Posek, a Gaon in Torah, and he was very close to the Zionist movement, just as in that time there were Rabbanim who were very much disavowed with Zionism and turned away from Zionism. Rav Shmuel Molover was very close to Zionism, and he and two other well-known Rabbanim, Rabbi Yisrael Yehoshua, Yehoshua Mikutne, he's called, who wrote a famous sefer, Shas Shuvis, Yeshua's Molcho, and Rav Shmuel Zundel Klapish, who was the Rav, who was also a Rav at a Rosh Hashiva in Varsha. All three of them got together, and they devised this solution that, or the beginning of the solution that's called the Heter Mechira. And they said that if in fact the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, or if in fact it's agreed that you can eat the fruits and vegetables from non-Jewish land, or land that's owned by non-Jews, it's possible to sell the land. It's possible to sell the land to a non-Jew for a limited amount of time. They suggested for a two-year period of time, and then continue to work the land with certain kinds of exclusion, certain things that you would try to avoid to do. And that way, you would be able to actually accomplish both. You'd be able to work the land and sell the produce and be economically viable and keep the Shemitah. That was the idea. However, they made the Heter conditional upon the agreement of the Gadol HaPoskim in that generation, whose name was Rav Yisrael Chanan Spector. Rav Yisrael Chanan Spector, who was the Rav in Kovna. Even though he was the Rav in Kovna, he was internationally renowned. He wrote many, many Sfarim containing thousands of tshuvas. And these three Rabbanim, the three Rabbanim that I mentioned, they said, we have a good idea, and we think that the Heter Mechira is a possible solution, but we make conditional our solution on the agreement and the support of Rav Yitzchok Chanan. Rav Yisrael Chanan agreed. He said that this is in fact the halacha, and this is how it should be done. This was the Heter Mechira that was originally constituted at the end of the 19th century, which was accepted by some of the Moshavim in Eretz Yisrael, Nes Tziona, Petah Tikva, some of the Moshavim. At the same time, the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim, Rav Shmuel Salant, the old Rav of Yerushalayim, the famous Rav of Yerushalayim, Rav Shulev Diskin, who was the Rav of Brisk and then went to Yerushalayim, came out against the Heter Mechira. And they said that this Heter is unacceptable. Rav Yisrael Chanan, when he came out in favor of the Heter Mechira, when he authorized the Heter Mechira, he also emphasized that the Heter Mechira, that his agreement was only for this year. It was only for the year that they were asked. It wasn't a blanket Heter. It wasn't something that would be instituted for many, many years. Now, as a result, because of the fact that the Heter that was instituted by the Rabbonim in Europe and given authorized by Rav Yisrael Chanan was a heter that was originally an annual one, one that was done for a particular year. It turned out, as a result, that every single subsequent Shemitah year, the problem of what to do arose over again. And this is the historical point which is important, I think, for us to be aware of. There are different kinds of heterim in Jewish history. But generally, heterim in specific issues are either accepted or rejected. The history of the heter that enables us to deal in business and take and give interest, which is called by various names, some kind of a heter iska, it's called. It's some kind of a way that we are able to avoid the stricture of the Torah against giving or taking interest from a Jew. Now, however that heter is constituted, it's also a heter. It's a heter which enables me to kind of avoid the intention of the Torah. And that's very clear. That heter, the heter iska, has generally in history not had any dissent. I mean, once that heter became part of the fabric of our existence, we don't find that every month or every year or every 2 years, Rabbonim come and they say, well, let's reinvestigate the heter iska. It doesn't seem to happen. The Prus book is a Prus book. I mean, nobody, I haven't heard, even in the religious neighborhoods that I frequent, that there's a movement to do away with the Prus book. I mean, I haven't heard of this, right? Because a heter is generally constituted, just as an iser is generally constituted in absolute terms. This is what you can do, or this is what you should avoid doing. The heter, called the heter mechira, was originally constituted, and then later on verified in the work that Rav Kook Zatzal wrote called Shabbat Haaretz, that the heter mechira, is something that has to be always reinvestigated. Every Shemitah, you have to sit down again and decide whether you're going to invoke the heter mechira. So that the argument from history is that the heter mechira, although it was established, and even though it had opposition, which is not so strange, or not even that important, because Rav Yitzhak Chanan is authoritative enough for the heter to be used by Jews, in my opinion. However, this heter included that special catch in it, which Rav Kook himself reiterated. And Rav Kook himself, by the way, it seems, did not use the heter mechira, since he was matter the use of fruits and vegetables through the heter mechira. He himself always avoided using it. And there's a famous story about Rav Kook. Somebody wrote to him, a good friend of his, on a Shemitah year, and asked him, a chutz la'aretz, asked him to send him an esrog. Apparently, this was a custom that these friend Rav Kook would send an esrog to his good friend in chutz la'aretz whenever he could. And he wrote him a letter, and he asked him that if he could make sure next year to send him an esrog. And he said that, and the answer was, you know, Rav Kook was a poet, and everything he wrote was poetry. So he writes in his letter that he would like very much to fulfill the wish of his friend and the tug of his friend's heart to do the mitzvahs, tugging at his heart, and he wants to send him an esrog, but since it's Shemitah, and since the Esrogim have Kedusha Shviyah, so there's an Isser to take Peros of Kedusha Shviyah to Chutz La'aretz, so he can't send them an Esrog. This is a letter that exists and that indicates that Rav Kook himself probably did not use the Heter the Heter Mechira. Now, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, because when I say Rav Kook, we're talking really about a different world. We're talking about a different Eretz Yisrael, and we're talking about a different prophet. When we talk about Rabbi Yisrael Chonon and the Rabbonim in Chutz La'aretz in Varsha, who were Mater, the Heter Mechira, we're talking about Jews who were Shomrei Torah of Mitzvahs, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, who were farmers, and who looked for a way to maintain themselves. They didn't want to go under. And the tshuva that was written by the Rabbonim in Chutz La'aretz to the farmers in Eretz Yisrael was written to religious Torah observant Jews. And to them, the Heter Mechira was direct. It never occurred to Rav Yitzchok Chanan that he was writing a tshuva for Shomer Tzair Kibbutzim, for example. I mean, Shomer Tzair Kibbutzim, the farmers of Shomer Tzair Kibbutzim, they might have known what Shemitah was about, because after all, many of them came from some sort of traditional educational system before they broke away. But they were no longer in the mode where they were asking rabbis questions. In the time of Rav Kook, you could see if you read in the Shabbat Aretz, Rav Kook, because of his understanding of world history, of what was happening to the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, sees the issue in more cosmic terms. Whereas, what are the Jewish people going to do? How are the Jewish people going to live? Is it economically viable for the Jewish people to keep Shemitah right now? In other words, the question was changed from somebody coming in asking a Rav, is this chicken kosher or treif, to an entire nation coming and asking the Rav, what should we do? Even though that entire nation was not Torah observant. And as a result of Rav Kook's particular position, even though the Heter Mechira was continued to be a subject of dissent amongst Rabbanim, especially the Radvaz, wrote strongly against the Heter Mechira, not to say, again, the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim kept writing against the Heter Mechira. I mean, this was something that went on and on. But as a result, when the Rabbanut HaRashit was established in Eretz Yisrael, I mean, even though Rav Kook was the Rav HaRashi of Eretz Yisrael, he, of course, lived before the Rabbanut HaRashit, the modern Rabbanut HaRashit. That tradition was instilled by Rav Kook, with the Heter Mechira was an answer to a question that we really wished somebody was asking, but nobody was asking. The question was, we, Klal Yisrael, all the Jewish people, what's going to happen if all the Jewish people decide to stop growing fruits and vegetables? I mean, what will happen to us here? Of course, the Jewish people were not asking that question, right? You understand? It was a sort of like the Rabbanut went to the farmers who were not Shomer Mitzvahs and didn't know what the Torah was and had no interest in Kashrus, let alone Shemitah. And they said to them, listen, you know, the next year Shemitah, and you have a problem. You're not going to be able to grow anything. They're looking at the Rabbonim, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, so then the Rabbonim say, but we're going to help you out with the Heter Mechira. And then at the end, everybody drank a little schnapps, and they were all happy. So that you understand that there was a major change, that it's not the same. It's not exactly the same. When we speak about the economic problem in the state of Israel, if everybody would stop farming their land, you have to understand that no one for an instant thought that anybody would ever stop farming their land, right? I mean, who's going to stop farming their land? All the farms in Israel, 99% of the farmland and of the produce in Israel today, 99.7% is produced by Arabs and non-religious Jews, neither of whom would be interested in asking too many questions about Shemitah. So that really, the Rabbanut has adopted a different position about the Heter Mechira. The Rabbanut, I mean, this is something you have to understand because it's part of the history. They say, why is it that the Rabbanim, why is it that the Rabbanim who do the Heter Mechira, why don't they use the Heter Mechira? This was in the last Shemitah, like a very scandalous, you know, in the secular newspapers, they went around and they polled all the Rabbanim in the Moetzet Rabbanut Rashit, or they polled all the Rabbanim who were Rabbanei Ha'ir, right? Rabbanim in cities around Israel, all of whom were involved in the Heter Mechira. And they said to them, do you use the Heter Mechira? And then like 100% of them said no. Right, so they say, what do you mean? You know, you're giving hashgacha on the chicken and you're not eating the chicken? What kind of deal is that? They say, you have to understand that the weight, that the focus of the Heter Mechira changed from 1898 till 1948, from a time when people who wanted to keep the Torah and the mitzvahs were asking questions, to the time when they didn't even ask the question. Like, I was foisting upon them this heter in order that they should not be over on Issa Drabbanon, even though they don't know what I'm talking about. They don't know what the Issa Drabbanon is. They don't know what it means to be over in Issa Drabbanon. They're Ochlei Nevelos and Trefos, Rachbono Litzlan. But I want now the Heter Mechira. The Heter Mechira became a tool that I could use to be Mezakeh Yisrael. I could help them. I could help the Jewish people with whatever. And even though the Heter Mechira was problematic, and we'll tell you what the problems of the Heter Mechira are, even though it was problematic, but the Gedolei HaRabbonim had come out in favor of Heter Mechira. This I'm talking about Rav Yisrael Chonon and then Rav Kook. Certainly we should be able to use the Heter Mechira in order to protect Jews from themselves, from doing terrible things to themselves. We use the Heter Mechira. However, the Rabbonim more and more became convinced that there is no reason for the individual who wants to keep Shemitah in a more significant manner, who feels that the Issa Drabbanon is something that should be addressed in a more serious manner, there's no reason to accept upon himself the heter of the Heter Mechira. This took a great, we're talking about history now, right? All of this part is still history and not halacha. And the last historical point that I want to make is that in 1967, there was a war in Israel. As a result of the war in Israel, a lot of agricultural land farmed by Arabs became incorporated in the state of Israel. And suddenly it became the simplest thing in the world for the Yerushalayim method of Shemitah to become available to great numbers of people. In other words, what happened was, suddenly everybody realized that Tnuva, the great consortium that moves fruits and vegetables around Israel, right? From the farmer to the consumer, or from the farmer to the diaspora, right? Tnuva does that, right? Not only Tnuva, there are several other large groups, but Tnuva also does it. That means that now Tnuva will have a truck coming from Jenin filled with tomatoes, all of which were grown by Jews. And they'll have another truck coming from Afula, full of grown tomatoes grown by Arabs, right? Jenin, a truck full of tomatoes grown by Arabs. Afula, a big truck full of tomatoes grown by Jews. And therefore, Tnuva. Tnuva without any difficulty. Without any difficulty at all. A little bit of difficulty. You have to watch, make sure that, you know, the drivers of the trucks don't get drunk and this guy doesn't go to Yerushalayim and that guy doesn't go to Tel Aviv. But it suddenly became possible to employ the heter that was used in Yerushalayim all the years for Shemitah with great ease. It suddenly became easy to get Arab produce exclusively on the Shemitah year, and after 1967, more and more B'nai Torah first, people who were interested in doing the halacha in a better way, because of the fact that the option became so easily available. I mean, true, it cost a little bit more money, but it did not, it was not a problem. People were willing to make that investment in order to do the mitzvah, or in order to avoid doing the averis of Shemitah in a more serious manner. So more and more people got involved in Yerushalayim in eating fruits and vegetables according to the Pesach of the Gedolei Rabbonei Yerushalayim, which was that it's allowed to use the fruits and vegetables that are grown by Arabs. This solution, by the way, became so effective. This really became so effective that in Tzahal, in the army, in the last Shemitah, when I was still there, it was not a problem for anybody anywhere to get fruits and vegetables from with a heter or with a hechsher of some badat in Tzahal. It was, they made it available to every soldier. It was quite a quite an undertaking, but theoretically, every soldier, wherever he was, they would give him fresh fruits and vegetables separately, right? Not the same fruits and vegetables. The army itself did accept the heter mechira for the soldiers, but any religious soldier who asked was able to get fruits and vegetables. Now, this is not only the result of the fact that the army wanted to supply these fruits and vegetables to the soldiers, but it's also a result of the fact that